Good evening. KQRIW here. At this time, Mel and Vic begin the TechNet. Main purpose of the TechNet, as you probably already know, is to try to answer people's questions about this somewhat complicated hobby called ham radio, and to show them some of the things that are fun, some of the things that are challenging, some of the things that are hard to understand. One of the big subjects we discuss an awful lot is antennas, for a very good reason. Modern-day ham radio operators have the choice of building lots and lots of different kinds of antennas. There's probably 1,000 different kinds of antennas you could build, if you so were inclined. Back in the good old days, way back when Mel and I were cutting our teeth in ham radio, he was something like 13 years old, and I was something like 16 years old. Lots of guys would build their own transmitters, but very few of them would build their own receivers. We bought receivers, or built them as kits. But we tended to build transmitters. And along came frequency synthesizers and integrated circuits. And now you've got the equivalent of 52 functions inside of a transmitter, and all kinds of fancy doodads, and digital signal processing, and very few people build their receivers anymore. Nobody builds their transmitters anymore. So antennas are what we can fiddle with. Antennas, transmission lines, and antenna support systems, towers, things like this. So that happens to be a pretty big subject for reasons like that. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Typical sign-in would sound like this. N2EO, Rich, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
This is KC2QYW, the name is Joe, and no question at this time.
This is Whiskey 2, Papa, November, Juliet, and it was Bob. No questions at this moment.
Okay, so good evening. This is K2KEY.
Who was that masked man? That was Mel. So far we've got Joe, Bob, and Mel. Anyone else? Give me a call letters and name at this time.
This is W2AOJ Mobile, Whiskey 2 Alpha Oscar Juliet, Long Branch, New Jersey, calling in by.
And Mr. Long Branch, New Jersey, do you think it's possible you might have a question later or at this time?
No, I'm afraid not. I am a complete loss for questions. Go ahead.
Okay, there's a person who has no questions. He knows what he needs to know. I wish that was true for Mel and me. Okay. Anyone else with any questions or comments? Give me your call letters and name at this time. Okay, Mel, look at that. We finally hit success. Let's see. I began in 1985. I think it was 85. 82. 1982. So this coming September will be 25 years. You got heavily involved a few years ago. It's only taken us a few years to answer all the questions, Mel. And there's no more questions left. We've used them all up. What's the latest in Manhattan Beach? K2KEY, K2LAW.
Okay. Good evening again. This is K2KEY here in Brooklyn. What's the latest? Latest. Not a heck of a lot. Been busy with other things. And ham radio, little ham radio here and there. Band conditions on the HF band have not been too good. Still sitting on the bottom of this cycle. And at times, you don't hear very much in the way of activity, especially on anything above 40 meters. Some activity you will find 20 meters during the daytime, but with the sunset, you usually will find some activity left on 40, and of course the 75 meter groups that do get on. And that's the extent of HF, if you want to really call, include 6 meters, down that a little bit. I guess we're a borderline, our borderline band. And 6 meters sometimes is surprising because there are openings on 6 meters that come occasionally. Some very unusual openings too. But as far as the beginning of the news cycle, I hope everybody, you know, is getting a little discouraged because there are a lot of new people who have come in with now privileges, HF privileges, and they're complaining to me and telling me, well, what can I do? I said, unfortunately, I can't give you any suggestions. I have no control over Mother Nature. Well, should I hold off buying a new radio? And because a lot of the radios today, you have a lot of nice, sophisticated DSP filters and all that. Something you don't really get to use much anymore. There's not so much in the way of QRM problems right now. So the point is, by the time I get we get back to those types of conditions, there's a pile up on 20 meters, you know, and lots of QRM situations. I think your new radio may be somewhat obsolete. You know, it's almost like you have a number of models that have come out after that. So they complain to me, how do you really determine how good the radio is? You know, is this radio really going to do the job for me? And, well, there isn't any really bad ones on the market right now. So the only thing I can say is go with your pocket for what you can afford to purchase. I don't think you're going to go wrong with any of the radios that are on the market today. They all work quite well. And as Dick said, back in the good old days, and that's a lot of years ago, yes, of course, I took all my rigs and all the transmitters and the receivers were all surplus. World War II vintage tube receivers that basically worked quite well when, you know, for the time. Very satisfied. Of course, we have no single sideband for an IBM. So it was CWNAM. And no RTTY, no slow scan or any of those more or less newer communications. So CWAM were the two, and those receivers suffice for that. So it was an interesting time to get into ham radio, and it was a lot of crafting doing. A lot of home brewing was commonplace, so I had my experiences with it. My Vic also, I'm sure, did his share of building. So that's the story. K2RIW was TechNet, K2KY.
Yeah, my first receiver was the Heathkit AR3, a 5-tube radio that covered the AM broadcast band up to 30 megacycles inclusive. That 5-tube radio worked pretty good on 80, 40, and sort of was usable on 20. On 15 and 10 meters, it was very marginal, low in gain. On 10 meters, the image, 910 KC away, was about 3 or 5 dB weaker than the real. In other words, every signal appeared twice on the dial, 910 KC apart, when you're on 10 meters. And that was true of a simple superhead with 5 tubes and nowhere near enough selectivity to the first RF amplifier when it got up to 30 megacycles. I eventually added a Q multiplier to it. That helped an awful lot when it comes to separating the Morse code signals on 80 and 40 meter CW. Without the Q multiplier, you would hear 5 or 10 guys at once. With the Q multiplier, you could select 1 or 1.5 people. And that was a Heathkit addition, the Q multiplier. It really was a sharp-tuned stage you add to the IF strip. It was a sharp-tuned regenerative amplifier. As you tune the regeneration knob on the Q multiplier, just before the point of oscillation, it would be an extremely sharp, oh, I'm going to guess, half a KC or 1 KC wide filter is what it was. and it worked reasonably well until a strong signal came along and would jump it into oscillation. My first transmitter was a 6W6 tube, which was a smaller equivalent of a 6L6, the audio output tube used as a oscillator, final amplifier, all in one. It operated on 80 meters and 40 meters, depending on which coil you plugged in. I think the design itself came out of a popular electronics magazine, which was sort of popular in those days. And 25 watts output, and I think novices were allowed to run only 25 watts. It could be wrong, maybe it was 75 watts, or maybe that was later on. 3700 to 3750, and something like 7150 to 7200, I think, were the novice CW portions of the band. A novice operator only had 80 and 40 meters and 2 meters were the only places we were allowed to operate with a novice license. I guess I had the novice license for a couple of months, went and got a general license in that couple of months, and then a couple of years later went and got an extra class license. I'm trying to remember what my second transmitter was. Oh yes, a pair of 1625 tubes. I think the 25 watts dissipation each. Plus, I think the rig ran around 100 or 120 watts. It was a transmitter amplifier, transmitter boosting amplifier, I would call it. Ran with an 850 volt power supply. And I do remember building that power supply and making the mistake of touching the two outer leads of the transformer while it was plugged in. And that was very exciting. I now realize that I came dangerously close to creating a fibrillation and therefore electrocution. Just my two fingers that touched, two fingers on the left hand and two fingers on the right hand touched the outer lead of the center tap transformer, the secondary winding, which I guess is around 1600 volts peak to peak, 850 volts each side of center tap. That was an 800 volt power supply that ran those 1625 tubes. I could have that backwards. May have been 800 volts, 400 watts, 400 volts inside. No, I think it was 800. It was 800 volts that the transmitter ran with. I'm trying to remember what my next receiver was. I think it was a Drake 2B. A poor man's Collins. Drake, the Drake Company in Miamisburg, Ohio, made some extremely nice equipment. The Drake 2B became very popular. The Drake R4C, I later owned one of those. And that is a very bulletproof receiver. It had a noise blanker you could add to it, but I don't think anyone has copied that performance yet. When I was using that later on 432 megacycles and listening to the Montauk Point radar, which is 70 miles from the Montauk Point, but that radar ran a gigawatt of peak envelope power, something like that, tremendous amount of power, 135 foot wide antenna, and something like 10 megawatt pulses going into that antenna. I'm guessing that antenna had something like 35 dB of gain, so we can go through the numbers. It was huge. It was the over-the-horizon radar for the air defense identification zone of the East Coast of the United States. So that radar, from time to time, would give me a signal 130 decibels above my 432 megacycle receiver threshold. I could plug in that much attenuation between the receiver and the antenna and still hear that radar. At that point, the signals were coming through the power supply of the receiver more than through the front end attenuator. But one with signals that strong, using the Drake R4C receiver as a tunable IF on my 432 converter, crystal control converter, converted everything down to 7 megacycles, and I tuned across 7 megacycles with the Drake R4C receiver. And with this noise blanker, I could aim the antenna directly at that radar. 130 dB above the noise pulses would be completely removed. You wouldn't know the radar was there. Night and day, an extremely weak signal coming into the back lobes of that antenna from New Jersey when I'm aimed to the east. I would have no trouble hearing the New Jersey ham when that noise blanker was turned on. I could aim my antenna directly at the guy in New Jersey, who would be giving me a 50 dB out of the noise signal, The radar is in the deepest back lobe I could find in that antenna. I turned off the noise blanker, and I would hear absolutely nothing but that radar. Nothing else was there. So that's a noise blanker. It's way ahead of any other noise blanker anyone has ever created. I dissected that circuit to figure out how Mr. Drake did that. And it's a really beautiful piece of engineering. By then, I had used 6 meters. The transmitter that I built, I'm trying to remember, the third transmitter I built was all transistorized. This was 1959, 1960 time frame. Frequency synthesized transmitter that covered 50 to 54 megacycles inclusive in four bands. Crystal controlled, frequency synthesized, all transistorized, 1 watt output, narrowband FM modulation, built-in Vox circuit. There must have been about 20 transistors all packed into a small mini box with a great big Millen dial in the front. Ran on 110 volts. I used an audio output transformer as the power transformer. The input winding from the audio output transformer, which normally went to something like an audio output 6L62, that became the 110 volt input, and I wound another secondary winding on there so that I could get a regulated 12 volt power supply built into this transmitter. 4x5x6 foot box, as I remember, a standard box that you could buy at the time. Still got that transmitter. Quite a significant piece of engineering by my standards at that time. The reason I wound my own transformer is you couldn't go into Radio Shack. It didn't exist. You went into, later on, Lafayette Radio or Harrison Electronics or, trying to think of the name of the place they had in Farmingdale. It'll come to me in a minute. Arrow Electronics. You couldn't buy a transistorized power supply transformer in those days. It didn't exist. You had to wind your own. And so, I learned about transformers. Very few amateurs, very few engineers are comfortable with transformers. Just a simple power transformer. How do you know when you got the right number of turns on the primary? The turns ratio between primary and secondary, whether or not it steps up or steps down the voltage by that ratio, almost everybody knows that. But how do you know you've got the right number of turns on the primary winding? And the right gauge of wire, the right winding of pitch, the right diameter of the wires, and so on. Not many engineers are comfortable with that. I don't think one amateur in 30 could speak on that subject with confidence. Maybe they don't need that information anymore, but that's just sort of a fact of life. So that was a 6 meter transmitter. Had an awful lot of fun with that on 6 meters, the so-called magic band. Used that from 1959 to 1969. Moved into my house in Huntington. I decided not to push my luck, and I discontinued the use of 6 meters because I was afraid that I'm a new kid on the block. It was a house I had bought. The previous house was a rental house, and if the Tennessee Valley Indians got too strong, I could just move. But the new house, I had really put down roots. Set up a 100-foot tower, bought an acre of property, and man, I was committed. I knew I was going to stay there. I didn't want to aggravate the neighbors, so I didn't use 6 meters. I'm now dreaming about getting back on 6 meters. I own a good single sideband 6 meter transmitter, a half kilowatt amplifier. I own a 6 meter, six element Yagi antenna. I got 100 feet of Rhone 55 tower with an empty spot on the mast. The mast is in the tower. There's an empty spot on the mast where the 6 meter Yagi could go. And the magic band, 6 meters, is something I probably should go and do. And they call it the magic band because almost every kind of propagation you can think of is on 6 meters. Ground wave, extended ground wave, tropo ducting, D-layer absorption, E-layer propagation, sporadic E propagation, F1 propagation, F2 propagation, trans-equatorial propagation, meteor scatter, moon bounce, aurora propagation, aurora reflection. The only kind of propagation I know of all the zillions of kinds of propagation that does not seem to exist on 6 meters, is rain scatter, which is something you get on 10 gigs, and 5 gigs, and 3 gigs, and higher. That's the one propagation I know of that doesn't exist on 6 meters. And I've also done building bounce propagation, bouncing signals off the World Trade Center when it was there, on 10 gigs. And that's not so easy to do on 6 meters. Although I've done that on 432, I've intentionally reflected signals off aircraft and off of buildings on 432. But that's the only mode I can think of. Rain scatter and building bounce and aircraft bounce is not a popular mode of propagation on 6 meters, but just about everything else is there. You get band openings of 1, 2, and 3, hop, skip, tropo, sporadic E combinations that'll get you to, on the first hop, you'll be talking to guys in Michigan, on the second hop, you'll be talking to guys in California, on the third hop, you'll be talking to guys in Hawaii, and maybe even Japan, and England, and so on. And some of this is predictable by way of the sunspot cycle and solar outburst and whatever, and some of it is not. So for people who call it the magic band for a whole lot of reasons, it's got 4 megs of bandwidth, 50 to 54 megs. It's got the FM people from around 52 and a half up. It's got the single sideband people at 125, I think is the calling frequency. Below 50.1, everybody uses Morse code. Above that, when the band starts opening, they scatter everywhere from 50.1 to 50.5 probably, and maybe even beyond when really good band openings occur. So now that everybody's on cable TV and television interference is almost non-existent, after all these years, let me think now, 69 and 38 years, I've been off that band for 38 years. I think it's time I go back to it. Have an awful lot of fun with it. I use narrowband FM modulation because the transistors I could get a hold of in 1959 was an extremely exotic Westinghouse transistor capable of 1 watt output, 50 or 100 megacycles of operation. At those days, with 1 watt of output, was kind of rare. And this Westinghouse transistor was declared a reject at Telephonics Corporation, and I built a transmitter around it. I was working as a technician in the final testing department with Jim Ratty at Telephonics Corporation starting in 1958, ending in 1964. But one of the ways that technician work, as well as my radio and television repairs, the way I worked my way through college. So that gives you a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of what is the very early days of ham radio back in 1956 to 1960. Or so, what it was like. Sam Harris, W1FZJ, was starting to write articles about setting up a 28-foot dish in his backyard in Swampscott, Massachusetts. He called himself the Swampscott VHF Society. He called himself a few other things. And eventually, he became real famous, and he needed his mark down at the Arecibo dish in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, the 1,000-foot diameter radio telescope. And he moved down there and set up an auxiliary radio telescope just like it a couple of miles away. So he was doing his thing. The Cadillac transmitter in those days was a Clegg Zeus and Clegg Interceptor. These were $1,000 rigs in 1963 time frame. $1,000 for a rig in 1963 was, by our standards then, an awful lot of money. And that was a 6-meter and 2-meter transmitter with a free-running oscillator. Nice big cabinet. I think it ran something in the vicinity of 300 watts, 500 watts of output. Really potent transmitter on 6 meters and 2 meters. Made by the Clegg Company, and I believe their headquarters was in New Jersey. Can't think of the call letters now of Mr. Clegg. I bet some of you guys already know his call letters, and he built a really solid rig for his day, just before frequency synthesizers started becoming popular. great big large inductors and capacitors in the VFO circuit to try to give it stability. It had about a half hour warm-up time where it would do some drifting of quite a few KC for the first half hour. I bet you've heard about the Clegg Zeus and Clegg Interceptor, Mel. And because it was so darn expensive, my roommate in college fell into a whole lot of money. His father died and left him an inheritance, and that's the way he spent it, for the Clegg Zeus and Clegg Interceptor. I bet you and I were dreaming about it, but couldn't quite afford it in those days. KQKEY, KQLIW.
Clegg Interceptor Receiver, WB2HWW.
Yeah, the receptor was the... The interceptor was the receiver, the Zeus, I think, was the transmitter. If I got that right, Howie. All right, go ahead, Mel.
This is KQKEY. Yeah, I guess I remember quite well. No, I couldn't afford much of anything, to tell you the truth. Came along the same way as you did, like you mentioned, doing the TV repairs and all the whatever. And so there wasn't any money left over for much in the way of amateur radio, so everything more or less was homebrew, and went along the same thing with the 807, Union 1625, sorry, I used 807. Basically what Dick was saying, 1625 to 12 volt filament, different of the 807, same two, 1625 12 volt filament, 807 to 6 volt filament. Again, all surplus stuff that, as far as power transformers, as Dick said, yeah, well, what I did, I remember I made a built a rig, needed a power transformer, salvaged one at a time out of a Dumont TV. They had a humongous, huge power transformer there to drive their 36-tube TV set. And I took that transformer, stripped out, I remember I took out the some of the windings that I didn't need in there. They had a number of 5-volt windings to drive the rectifier. And so I made that separate so that I wound myself, I don't know, I remember how I got myself a power, good power transformer out of that. And so on and so forth. Basically, the same thing. First rig was 6L6, built on a wooden chassis, used crystal that was amateur novice. We had 80 and 40 meters and 2 meters by heavy crystal control. Dropped to, allowed up to 75 watts, but very few of them ever did run 75 watts, and built that first tool rig on a wooden chassis from the ARRL book on how to become an amateur radio operator. And so on and so forth, went along the same way. Of course, the novice license at that time eventually was expanded to give us 15 meters, and didn't have the novice license also very long. Basically got it, went down the FCC. Those days, is to get a novice license, you have to go to the Federal Communications down here in Washington Street, New York, and take any of your licenses there, whether it be novice, tech, or general, advanced, or extra. Of course, there was no real advantage to anything other than the general and getting or getting the advanced or the extra. They did exist, but they had no extra privileges at the time. That didn't come till later years. So I had novice class in December when we had the break for Christmas break from school, and then went back when we finished up in June, went back and took my general. So that's basically the same. Everybody there basically did the same thing in those days. And as Dick says, they were interesting days. And, I got knocked by plenty of power supplies. I got belted around, shot galore, whether it be working on a TV set or a piece of ham equipment. We always get belted, but I guess we were young, we could take it, Dick. K2RIW, KKEY.
WB2HWW, a couple of comments from the subject.
Got to turn it over to you in a second, Howie. The power transformers at a television set, I think, fully an awful lot of ham transmitters were built from those. And I believe they were good for at least 100 or so watts, if not more. The more I think about it, I think I did use 807, not 1625. I owned some 1625, but the filament transformers, the power transformers you get from television sets, had 6.3 volt windings, but they didn't have a a 12-volt winding. So I did use a pair of 807s. In that particular case, it was a homebrew chassis to make it the right shape, so that this rig would have the two 807 tubes and they are laying side by side, sideways. 866s were the tubes in the power supply, mercury vapor rectifiers, and as you talked into that rig, you would watch the mercury vapor rectifiers flash. They would be changing their brilliance as the current was changing through the rectifiers when you amplitude modulated. It was a screen, so-called screen grid modulation that I was using. I didn't own a audio output transformer by which I could do high-level AM modulation. So I was screen modulating with them. I forget how I was doing the screen modulation right now. I'm also forgetting what was the transmitter. Oh, yeah. I do remember building a homebrew VFO around that time, which wasn't a great performer. My first rig for the novice band was crystal controlled. The 6L6 tube, or the 6, I think it was a 6W6 tube, slightly smaller version of the 6L6, ran 25 watts of output. The crystal plugged into that rig. I had 7 megacycle crystals and 3.7 megacycle crystals for 80 meters and 40 meters, respectively. And so the oscillator, crystal control, oscillator, and power output is all in one tube. And if you adjusted it correctly, you had very little chirp each time you keyed that transmitter. You keyed it by grounding the cathode. When the cathode was ungrounded, the oscillation and the power output would stop. Mine was built on a metal chassis. And I think the power supply was on the same chassis, a metal chassis. Mel built his on a wooden chassis. And following Comptier Electronics magazine, somewhere around 1962, they had an article for an FM radio. For transistors to get all the way up to 100 megacycles in 1962 was a real struggle. RCA had come out with this fancy little transistor called